Today is Wednesday, April 21, 2021. This is a part 10, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Nancy Mulledy Meekum, last name spelled Mulledy hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I am good, Tom. It's so good to hear your voice again and to talk to you about all this fun stuff from my past.
You too. I really appreciate your taking the time to do this, Nancy. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Picking up the thread from the end of part 9, you were introducing us to the Equal Employment Opportunity, EEO, as it's known,
yeah,
role that you played in the Park Service starting around 1995. Can you pick that thread up for us, please?
I can. That was a program that is in throughout the U.S. government and in many major, I would say, businesses now. And it is an avenue for people who feel that they have been wronged to appeal those wrongs based on very specific discriminatory categories, which includes gender, race, national origin, sexual orientation, which was added, and it addresses not just direct discrimination against a person, like we're not giving you that job because you're a woman, as an example, but creating a work environment that is considered hostile.
Okay.
So if somebody walks in and everybody's telling all these lewd jokes, for instance, or stories about somebody that, like if they are of Asian descent and telling anti-Asian jokes, that would be a hostile environment. And you do not necessarily have to be in that category, the butt of the aim of those things, but if you are offended by the talk or the presentation or whatever's going on, you have a means to appeal. It's only under those specific categories. If somebody didn't give you a job because they just didn't like you, that's not an EEO thing. If you didn't get a, if somebody decided to shove you, that's, you know, a assault or a battery. If somebody actually touches you, it's a battery. If somebody threatens you, it's an assault. That is a criminal act. So this is one of those, EEO is one of those things that fills the gap between things where people were being discriminated against but had no other recourse to appeal.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear.
So I was sent with Joan Chacon Blaze. She got married, but I don't think she was married at the time. Joan Chacon, she was at Desert View, and I had worked with her at Sequoia National Park. And Kim Beesum from the South Rim. I think it was the three of us, but there could have been a fourth. We were sent to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and we flew there, I remember, out of a airport, I think out of the Flagstaff Airport, one of those little puddle jumpers that took us north, and landed there. And so we went and had this class, and it lasted several days, and we learned all about what the categories are, what to do if somebody comes to you, how to deal with all of this. And, you know, it was a very involved, very in-depth class. And one of the things that we found out, at least that I found out that I took away from this, is number one, unlike being a registered nurse and an ER nurse, I'm often an advocate for my patient. In this case, as an EEO counselor, I am not an advocate for anyone. I am the neutral go-between, and I don't want to ever take sides but present the facts so that people can make a determination. So that was a very interesting take on all of this. If somebody comes to me and say, I didn't get this job because they said I was a woman, I don't go back and go, well, that sucks, you know, let's take care of this. You don't do it that way. I'll go, well, let's get the facts, and I record what happens, and then I say very specifically, what would it take to make you whole, W-H-O-L-E. And that is the phrase that they teach us to use to say, okay, to make this go away, basically, so that you don't feel discriminated against, what do you need out of this?
Mm-hmm.
And that, it's sort of like, don't complain about something unless you can come up with a remedy for it.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's where it comes from. So that when I then present, take all the facts, present it to the administration part of things, because I don't present it to the person that did the evil deed. I present it to the person who can do something about it. And when I was the counselor, it was J.T. Reynolds, who was the deputy superintendent from 1995 to 1999. He was there, I think, for longer, but that is when I was the counselor. And when I would work with this person or interact with that person on any other venue, we never talked about it. JT and I were on a softball team together. We would never talk about cases. It was only very specific. It was very private and a need-to-know-only kind of situation. So if somebody – and that's to protect the person almost like a whistleblower kind of thing, I think. So in that period of time, I made plaques that went up in all of the major buildings so people knew who the counselors were. I brought back all the information I had because there had been no EEO counselors at the Grand Canyon. I don't know if ever, but there certainly wasn't when we were sent to this class.
Okay.
If people had an issue, they had to contact a counselor in an entire another park, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Grant, some other place. So this was a chance to make that happen here. So I sat down with all the notes that I had and all the papers, and there's a lot of paperwork to it, and I created an EEO counselor's handbook, which is about three-quarters of an inch thick.
Okay.
But it's, part of that is full of these sample things that you have to fill out, how to take a complaint, how to treat people, what are all of this stuff. And so it took a lot of time to put it together. But then as we recruited more counselors, I could give them the handbook, go through it. I was the lead counselor. And so oftentimes Kim or Joan would come to me. But one of the things I found out is a lot of people came to me, and I'd say, you know, I've got a lot of cases right now. Can you go to Kim or can you go to Joan? And it's not that they didn't feel that they were capable. They just didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people came to me because they knew me as a person. And one of the things that I always tried to foster as me as a person is integrity, honesty, doing the right thing, don't cut corners. And I know and I hope that I maintain that reputation amongst the community.
Yeah.
And so it was good that people came to me, but often I would have to refer them to others just because I would have a full plate. And when you did something outside of your job, because I was a GS-9 Protection Ranger with all the duties we've talked about to this point, including EMS coordinator and putting together the Resource Management and Protection Ranger, RMPR, that I will talk about later. This was just a lot of work, and when I would get a case, it would take supposedly 20% of my work time, but often it took a lot more than that, often what I would do on off-duty time, because as you know, as a protection ranger on the south end of the Grand Canyon, it was go, 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 it was call waiting. And
you bet. And if you had five cases, You're 20% times five. You can't do your job.
That's right.
Which is interesting. Let's step back for a minute. Three of you went to the training, and so three of you then had this title or were able to handle.
We were EEO counselors.
We're EEO counselors. How busy did you all get, and how quickly?
I never immediately. I'd have to say within days of people realizing. It's almost as if people were waiting for us to come back. I tried never to have more than three cases at any one time.
Right.
And there were times when I had no cases.
Okay.
But it took a lot because I would sit down with the complainant, man or woman, whatever it was, and I would go through a whole checklist that I had put in the handbook of what it was and made sure that they fit the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
One of my other duties was if it didn't fit an EEO criteria, my other job wasn't to say, sorry, I can't help you. I was required by law to refer them to what could help them. So
right,
if they said,
great.
My husband at home is beating me up, or whatever it is, then I would refer them to the South Rim District Ranger or somebody like that to make that complaint, or I would change hats. And I wouldn't take the complaint because I was an EEO counselor, and I'd refer them to whoever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And So I would have to do that, is help them find another avenue. But most people knew, because I put on the plaques what it was that we were looking for to help them with.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody didn't get the right days off, and they just didn't like the days off, or they didn't get their overtime, that would not fall into an EEO unless it was a discriminated class of person, or a person that was discriminated against.
Right.
So I'd have to refer them to their supervisor or the supervisor's supervisor, and then I would have to document all of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, I documented everything that they said to me, and this put it in a presentation package, and then I would go and make the presentation to administration.
And it sounded like there were enough kind of gray areas. Okay, if I was pushed, if I was assaulted, all right, then that's a chief ranger issue. You're going to need to go to law enforcement.
Right.
But it sounds like there were some gray areas. You would have to figure out where they fit.
Right. Wow. And when all else fails, I keep it as an EEO counselor, and then I would call somebody at region and bounce it off of them.
Okay.
And they would go, yep, you're right to keep it. Nope, send it on. So I wasn't an island all by myself. I had resources outside the park that I could talk to, because there were regional EEO contacts and stuff like that.
Great.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. All right. I've got a little call out here already to ask you. Maybe we talked about this already. What do you remember about James Reynolds, J.T. Reynolds?
Oh, J.T. J.T. Reynolds was one of the few black administrative officers that I've ever met in the National Park Service. I was in the Western Parks, except for I shouldn't say that. I was in Biscayne and Everglades. But in the National Park Service, I knew black protection rangers, black interpreters, but he was only the second administrator, and the other one, I'm afraid his name has escaped me, but he was the deputy superintendent for a while at Sequoia National Park, and I have an idea why that is. I think growing up in America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, middle America was post-war America, and primarily middle-class white people, and they got into the national parks, and then it was those people that became enamored with the parks and wanted to work with them. And I cannot speak, not being a black person, as to why that wasn't a part of their culture, but I see it changing now as there are more. And then if you go to where the population base has more of a mix of black people who go to like historical sites and battlefields and stuff, I see many more rangers of color and of other represented classes in the National Park Services. So I'm not a demographic specialist, but it was kind of striking to see so few there. But JT was one of those, and I know he started as a ranger in Yosemite, I don't know if he started as a ranger in Yosemite and other places. So he worked his way up the ranks, and I had an immediate rapport with him because he and I understood right away that we were there to do the right thing. We were there not for ourselves, and this is going to sound like blowing my own horn, but it is what I was. I wasn't, if I was in this planet for the pay, I would not have been a park ranger. You know, we didn't make very much money. We had to pay for rent and utilities, but to me, it was the job, being in nature and being purposeful for other people as well as nature, that made me thrive. And so JT, I could feel he was not there for himself. He was not there to get promoted as far as he could and make as much money as he could. He genuinely felt like he wanted to help people. He was always there if I had a need for something. He learned people's names. He reached out to people. There would be a call that you're on and you turn around and he would be in the crowd watching. So he was somebody who cared not only about you as a person, but as to the operation of the park and to what the park was there for, to protect and preserve and provide for the enjoyment of people and future generations. He was a good softball player.
Yeah, I was going to say, what else do you remember about him as a person? I mean, what you've just said is exactly how I think of him in the few times that I had the privilege of interacting with him at Grand Canyon. But just the ability to do the right thing and to care.
which I found was unusual, not in the National Park Service, but at Grand Canyon. And I've worked in many national parks, and as I mentioned this earlier, this park is like it's in its own sipapu, you know, its own birth area in the earth, and I don't know what's coming out of that hole in the earth, but it's it is Sequoia National Park. I felt really good in the 14 total seasons I was there. I received over 20 attaboys, you know, special achievement awards. I had great opportunities. Everglades, it was wonderful. You know, all the different places that I worked, Death Valley. You get to the Grand Canyon, and as in general, and again, a generalization, the place, the people are like, protect yourself over anybody else. Do what you can for you before anybody else. And it was a dog-eat-dog. And I will diverge to tell something that kind of explains things a little bit. And my husband, Kent Meekum, was the sub-district ranger at Death Valley at Furnace Creek when he got when he put in for the job at Grand Canyon. And so he was the structural fire specialist or chief fire chief at Death Valley, and had also done that at Lehman Cage, which is now Great Basin, and had gone to the National Fire Academy, was very experienced. And so the selecting official of all the people that applied selected Kent for the job. But another person who was already at the Grand Canyon, who was a person of color, who was on the fire brigade at the time, also put in for the job. And the person who was the selecting official knew that there could be an issue if it looked like they were bringing a white male in over a black male. And so she took the cert, which we call the certification, this is the certification, and sent it to Region and said, okay, now you guys decide if I'm making the right decision. And they did. So she knew by picking Kent Meekum that it was the most qualified person for the job. Before we got there, and actually I arrived before Kent because he got the job. We weren't married at the time. I got a seasonal position on South Rim as a protection ranger beginning in May. He didn't come till sometime after. There was a group of people that wanted this black male to be the fire chief. And as soon as I showed up, these people, a lot of them were on the night shift of South Rim Patrol, as well as working for the concession fire brigade, treated me very badly because I was associated with Kent. And it was really sad. And then when Kent showed up, he went on a call. I remember I was on this call. We went out to Duck on a Rock for a car fire, and he pulled up, and the night shift supervisor was there, and as well as three of the night shift people. And when he pulled up, Kent started saying, okay, you pulled the inch and a half, and you did this, and you did that. Nobody did anything. And the night shift supervisor turned to everybody, used some really colorful language, and said, he's the fire chief, get over it, do what he says. But that was our introduction to Grand Canyon, immediately a click, immediately hatred for just showing up.
And yet I think of someone like JT, who is just, and you as well, who are the exact opposite of that dog-eat-dog mentality.
And this was way before JT was there. This is in 1991.
Okay.
And so this was prevalent and accepted behavior. And I had, you know, I had very little recourse. And I was on a call with this black man who did not get the job, a full code where we were doing CPR and all that kind of stuff. And I was asking him to do stuff, and he never answered me. And I had to do it myself. It was just awful. And it was people who are not of my cloth, who are not of my thinking, who say, I didn't get this. I'm going to pout, and I'm going to make all my friends hate you as much as I hate you because I didn't get the job. And that's how Grand Canyon worked, and it was very sad.
I'm wondering if you put thought into this to try to trace it back. Has it always been that way since 1919? Or is this something that happened in the 40s or 50s or 60s? Did you ever ponder that?
I never gave it that much thought because I left. I prepared to resign my job and to leave. It was just such a hostile environment for me. And Kent talked me into staying, and then later we got married, and then I was sort of stuck. But he said it will get better. It got a little bit better as I learned the area. I learned who was not of evilness, and I'm going to use that word, evilness. And I already gave an example of two of the evil people who changed Kent's days off to force me to change my days off.
Right.
All I know is that before I showed up, or after I showed up, once people realized that I was a reasonable human being who cared about other people, then the complaints came in about the people who had this bad behavior, how they would wait outside the pub so they could get a DUI, the people who, like Keith Lover, who would take the penny away so somebody couldn't make bail and could go. There was a clique of people, and most everybody called them the night shift Nazis. The night shift. And I don't know how long it was. I do know that there was a set of people before then who did some really peculiar things as well. All I know is when I got there, it was an awful environment. I didn't want to stay at Grand Canyon. Luckily, I finished my 6 months at South Rim on the protection, and because I wasn't a permanent when I first got there, then I worked for 6 months as a interpreter, naturalist interpreter for Chuck Waller at Yavapai Museum. And talk about going from the total dark hole of Calcutta to the brightest, sunshining, most welcoming person on the planet. Chuck Waller was the perfect supervisor and the best supervisor I've ever had. And then because they had needed my skills, they would still call me out for a paramedic, or I'd go out as a member of the fire brigade or search and rescue, even as an interpreter. But it was then when I went back to South Rim for the summer shift on day shift, because back then you only had like three permanents and four seasonals, something like that. By that time, I had put my gumption up, and I wasn't going to take prisoners anymore. It was going to be leave me alone kind of a thing. So I have to say Grand Canyon changed my personality somewhat to being a harder person than I was before.
Interesting. And yet, when I think of you and I think of JT, he didn't fall for that. I don't know that you did either, at least not to the people that were outside of the night shift club. So
before JT, there was a deputy superintendent who had a very poor reputation.
I see. Okay.
And so they did. They were there to be part of the SES, the Senior Executive Service, to put in their time so they could be a superintendent somewhere at a Crown of Jewel Park and make $200,000 a year.
Okay.
So there were quite a few people who came and went who were there just to do their time and wanted to be part of the Good Old Boy Club.
Okay.
And the Good Old Boy Club I was not a part of.
Can you go back to JT for a minute? Any other stories you want to? That's all right. This is wonderful. That's very helpful. Just kind of understand it, and I'll still kind of be pondering, how did that whole thing start way before you showed up? But what else do you remember about some of the interesting things that JT did and you had a chance to work with him on?
He cared a lot. I remember we had a ceremony at the cemetery next to the Shrine of Ages, and it was really important for him that everything went well, that everybody was treated with respect, that even though we didn't start on time, it's because the people in wheelchairs didn't get there. That was important to him. And as I recall, and I may be wrong in this, I believe he was in the military. That was something that I related to, not that I was in the military, but my husband Ken had been in the Marine Corps. And so I really respected what he did. The thing about JT is when you would walk in the office, and this is even before I was a counselor, you walk by the hallway and he goes, Nancy, he'd call out to you. He'd see you walk by his office. Come in here. Talk to me. He would reach out to you. And it wasn't like you walked in and you were about to be pummeled for making a vehicle stop, or like you usually associate with being called, you know, on the carpet kind of thing. He went out of his way to find you, to talk to you about things that you didn't get in trouble for. You know what I mean? So you always felt like he was there for you. And so you would sit there and talk about all kinds of stuff. And you could see behind his eyes, and I can't describe it any other way, when I would bring certain cases to him as an EEO counselor, you could see, and this is my interpretation, him seething behind his eyes. But he would never bring his opinion into it, but he would say, we're taking care of this. We're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And his whole tone changed with the anger behind his words that this person was treated in that manner or something happened that way. Not that every complainant on an EEO complaint had a valid complaint, I have to say that.
Right.
But for those that were actually genuinely real, and I still respect everybody's privacy, and I will not tell any stories today except mm-hmm. the one which will be mine eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't tell about any of them, but there were some pretty wrong things done. He then, as a representative of the administration, would say, this is what we're going to do about it. He would meet up with the people who were the supervisors of the person and say, this is what's going to happen. It wasn't let's sit down and talk about this. JT didn't do that. He decided this is what is going to happen, and this is not going to happen anymore, or if this continues to happen anymore, this person will not have a job here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about transferring this person. This person will not be with the National Park Service anymore.
Right.
So when he realized what was going on, and the other thing that happened was, I shouldn't just say, somebody gave me a complaint and I went to JT. I did investigations. We were required to do investigations. So I would go in, I'd check the environment, I would talk to people around there. I would, you know, I just didn't show up and say, he said, she said.
Hmm.
And I would often go to the person they were complaining against and ask certain questions, not saying somebody said this. I'd say, tell me about this or tell me about that, and what do you do in this situation or whatever it was. And if he perceived that somebody had been wrong, he became a champion.
I can't help but think that JT himself, as an African-American, must have been discriminated against himself in the Park Service. I can only think about, it's a white male, white male dominated place that, you know, tons of stories of females slowly trying to work their way in and Native Americans slowly trying to work their way in. He must have seen it right directed at him. So I can understand.
I don't remember her that well, but his wife, and I can't remember her.
Dot.
Dot, yes, she was a kick, though.
Cool. What do you remember about her?
All I can remember is she was, when we would go to, like, parties or potlucks or something like that, she was the life. I mean, she was just like, JT, I would have to say, unless you were one-on-one with him, was stalwart, you know? She was like, almost could embarrass him with her enthusiasm and stuff. I mean, it's an impression I have. It's like, you know, Tom, when you go to a movie and you think about it like a month later going, oh, I couldn't tell you what it's about, but I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we remember our emotions, how we felt about something more than we do the details.
That's right.
And that's how we think about Dot, is I just remember she was a kick. She was fun.
Mm-hmm.
She was verbose and fun to just be around. And but I can't give you specific examples other than I can mentally see her at a particular party we were at.
Mm-hmm.
Just how fun it was to be around her.
Nice.
They retired to Henderson, Nevada, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thinking more than about the EEO role, what was it like to again, I think about jobs. And, you know, if I'm a house painter, I paint houses. If I'm in law enforcement, I have to deal with people who need help. I also have to deal with bad guys. As an EEO officer, I have to deal with frivolous complaints. I have to deal with serious cases of discrimination. I can't think but that could be wearing on you. How did
In a way, it was almost, for me, it wasn't wearing on me. It was almost, what is the word for it? Not uplifting. It gave me another tool. I might see something and I couldn't do anything about it. Now I was in a position to do something about it.
Empowering?
That's the word.
Okay.
Thank you.
How so?
Well, you know, in protection, if you put your hand out and you look at the fingers, and below the fingers is your palm, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
When I would go, I can remember specifically going to a fight over in Trailer Village. And it was a matter of like 3 or 4 people here. And so one of the first things you do is make sure nobody's fighting anymore. Nobody's really hurt, but everybody's still hot under the collar. So you separate everybody out. And if you, and in this case, if I was the investigative officer, your colleagues have your back, they're watching you, and they're keeping everybody separate. Now, we're getting everybody's statement. And so what I do is I hear what everybody has to say. And then the way I do it, and I get everybody, and I said, this is my perception of what's going on, if they're reasonable, not under the influence of drugs or alcohol and stuff. And I said, everybody put your hand here, and I make them put their hands out and put it where their fingers overlap each other. And I said, notice how nobody's palm is being touched. Only the fingers are being touched. This is the commonality of the story. Well, he shoved me first, he shoved me there. What's the commonality? People got shoved. You know, and so what I would do when all of these things is I'd get enough information to figure out what happened on based upon everybody's story and where they overlap.
Okay.
You know, and so when I have a complaint like an EEO, I would do the same thing. You know, tell me what happened. Tell me how this, and based upon these investigative skills that I learned at Santa Rosa, learned at FLETC, developed over time with experience. Being an investigator is not for everybody off the street, but I thrived in figuring out the puzzle. I mean, I remember figuring out a burglary at Victor Hall one time, and I was just so tickled at the end when I figured out who did it, because I talked about 13 different people and who was where when and who had what and all that stuff. So it was empowering because I could use these skills that I had in protection now to help people discriminated against.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. So it didn't bother me, but it was sad in some cases. It made me secretly angry in other cases. And it wasn't so much that it was made you dragged on you. The thing that I already had as a skill set was to not talk about people's medical conditions to other people, because in 1996 I got my RN, and I worked part-time as a board certified in emergency medicine nurse in the emergency room at Flagstaff Medical Center. And I might come and talk about in a teaching situation about a car accidents and decompressing a tension pneumothorax or something like that, but nobody's name ever showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody asked me, how did that patient do the other day? And they were on a scanner or something, and I always say they did fine, whether they died or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's none of their business. So I brought this skill set to EEO that, you know, nobody's going to hear from me what happened. If somebody hears about this complaint, it's not from me. So I already had that skill set. That being said, though, when you have so many people's confidences, it's not so much a juggling act to anything leak out. Because I put up such a firewall that nothing comes out, and therefore you don't talk to people about what you do as an EEO counselor. That's why this is an interesting conversation I'm having with you, to talk about the nuts and bolts without giving examples,
right,
other than off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's very fascinating to know how it works, and it's so interesting to know and good to know that you had backup in region. You had someone.
Yeah. I had JT.
Well, you did have JT.
He's the only one I could talk to about it, other than Regent.
Yeah, but above and beyond JT, outside of the park, another ear to listen and eyes to look around.
Yeah.
Very, very helpful.
That being said, I have to say that and this is just my observation, that 1 in 10 people made an EEO complaint that could have.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah, because you'd see stuff. And, you know, I might say, you know, you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. And they'd walk away or whatever.
Wow.
So and there, that Grand Canyon was, I hope it's not anymore, for a period of time that I was there, which was 18 years, was a very dysfunctional place in many ways. But I also have to say that, you know, once every other week, we'd have music night with Marker and a bunch of, you know, Lori Rome and all these other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have potlucks, and then you'd have softball games. So I don't want to give the impression that it was an awful place to live and everybody was awful. If you didn't learn to deal with the people, and it's interesting how only 6 or 7 people can make your life miserable, but if they're in a position of power, they can.
Right.
And then you either fight back or you swallow it or you leave.
Right.
And I was ready to leave. I didn't leave. I swallowed some, and then I began to fight back.
And why did you submit your resignation to be the EEO officer for the park?
I put in the letter that I just read the letter, so it's an easy answer, that it's time for other counselors to do it, because 5 years is a long time.
Hmm.
To concentrate on my other collateral duties, because I was a EMS coordinator, South Rim. I was doing the resource management protection ranger. I was also on search and rescue and the fire brigade. So I was called out probably 4 or 5 days a week.
Okay.
From my off time, easily. In the summertime, it's probably every day. But so I remember specifically when I applied for the South Rim supervisor position, thinking I was going to go from 110% to 125% of giving me, you know. And my husband, Kent, and I, we talked about how, you know, to do it right, I think that I had to be present a lot more than I was if I was – because my philosophy on supervision was, if you take care of the people, the operation takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you screw the people to try to make everything work, nothing works. And so I wanted to be there for the people.
Yeah.
I wanted to be there to make sure things worked out. And that was going to take a lot more time in addition to my job, in addition to the collateral duties that I had. So I believe two things. One, I let it go because it had been time. It was time enough. And I was also ready to apply for this other position.
Okay. That makes sense. Nancy, you also mentioned that in 1996, you became a registered nurse.
I did.
Can you?
I think it is. I walk over and look at my...
How did that happen? Did that just somebody came by and they were selling them on the street? No, it didn't. You had to work at that. When did you decide you're already a commissioned law enforcement officer.
Right.
When did you decide, and you're very skilled at interpretation, and here's a whole new field. You clearly love, emergency medical services.
Yeah.
How did you decide to do that?
It was a real simple explanation. Dual careers in the national parks are hard to come by. That means for a husband and wife to transfer to a park, it is rare that there's a job for both of them.
Okay.
So I thought if we went somewhere, being the female spouse at the time, I was going to follow Kent.
Okay.
And if there wasn't a job for me, I was going to have to do something else.
Okay.
I could be a seasonal, but if they didn't have seasonal positions, I can be a nurse. And my mom had been into cadet nurse during World War II. I already was well into enjoying having been a paramedic. In fact, I ended up being a paramedic for over 30 years. And teaching EMS, I was teaching EMT classes almost every year, and being the South Rim EMS coordinator. And it was a passion of mine to help people ever since I got my EMT after working in Death Valley. So it, the impetus was if we were to transfer and go to another national park. So already having a master's degree and having a lot of the classes that required like microbiology, you then can take, and being a paramedic for so many years, I then was able to take courses online. Even back then, there were actually correspondence courses. Take the courses like in gerontology and things like that. And then you challenge the exams of other things. And I would go to Northern Arizona University where they would have the exams on the weekend, and you take these 3 or 4 hour exams and you pass them or you didn't, and I passed them. And then I did my clinical down at Maricopa Hospital down in Phoenix area. And after several years, I got my RN. I got licensed in the state of California in 1997, I believe. I'm looking at, trying to look at this thing. So, okay, I was a student from 1994 to 1996. And then I was in November of 96, and I believe it was January of 97, I got my RN. And once that happened, I thought, well, I don't want to lose these skills. So I was always bringing patients to the emergency room at Flagstaff Medical Center, which is a level one trauma center. What does it take to be a level one trauma center versus level two versus not? Level one trauma center has a surgeon on duty and in-house 24/7.
Okay.
Level two has somebody of those skills, plus the nurses, plus the anesthesiologists, et cetera. Level two has them within 15 minutes of the hospital, and,
oh, wow,
et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
You can't be a trauma center unless you have these criteria. So I went to, oh, my gosh, I can't believe her name just went out of my head. Jennifer, I'll think of it in a second. Anyway, she was the director of the emergency room, and I brought her patients all the time and knew her, and I knew all the nurses there. And I said, I got my RN, and I said, I'm wondering if I could work here part-time. She goes, oh, we would love to have you here.
Wow.
And I said, but I have to tell you that, I do all the emergency skills, but I've only put a Foley catheter in one time, and I've only done this. She goes, Nancy, you're ACLS certified. You already know all the trauma and all the cardiac skills. She goes, that's what I can't teach new nurses. And new nurses usually have 2 years in the emergency room, and with you, you have a one-month preceptorship, and if you pass that, then you're good. So I was assigned with Stephanie Wiley, wonderful nurse, and I shadowed her for like a shift, and we had 12-hour shifts, and then within a short time, you know, she would watch me as I did all the skills, and she would help me with the skills that were new to me as an emergency provider. That you would do, like I said, putting a Foley catheter is not something you did very often. Mm-hmm. Assist with chest tubes, ventriculostomies, a few other things that you don't do. And then it was after my third shift that Jen and Steph came to me and said, it's ridiculous for you to be doing this anymore. You're cut loose.
Wow.
So I started working back-to-back shifts. So I would go on my days off to Flagstaff Medical Center once or twice a month and work back-to-back 12-hour shifts. And it was incredibly rewarding, really rewarding. And it was like the other side of the gurney. It bring them in, and I have a better appreciation of how people are packaged. And then you take, and I remember having nurses ride along with me, and I knew what Jen was thinking of, that a lot of nurses don't know how to do spinal precautions.
Ah.
You know, they don't know how to use a SAM splint because they're not pre-hospital care.
Hang on, wait, mm-hmm. Back up.
Uh-huh.
So what FMC wanted to do was get their nurses into a patrol car with you?
No, I'm just saying, no, not at all. They're just saying that I brought skill sets that they did not have.
Oh, so when you mentioned ride-along, they wanted the nurses that they had to hang out with you.
No. I don't know where the word ride along came from.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember saying that out. If I said it out loud, I didn't mean to say it. But anyway, no, she said, you bring a skill set, and as an example, nurses in a hospital don't know how to do spinal precautions.
Right.
They don't know how to start an IV in the back of a B speeding boat on Biscayne Bay,
right,
30 miles an hour, which I did one time. And you know, they live in a very clean and well-lit environment, and I was under a bridge one time under a car extricating somebody. So I was already calm. I already was confident in my skills. And so it wasn't like I was a new nursing student.
Right.
So other than learning some of the how to put things in Cerner, which is our computer system, how to get things out of the pharmacy, which is the drug cabinet that's locked and you have to use the computer to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than learning nuts and bolts, I pretty much walked in the door. And I worked there for 5 years before we left. Before we moved to California. So from the time, is that right, 5 years? No more than that. No, almost 10 years. What does my little thing say? They gave me a little thing. Let's see. I'm walking around to look at this.
Okay.
I think I was there for 8 or 9 years. Anyway, before I left the Grand Canyon.
Okay, so explain to me now how this would work. So you would, most of us are working 5 days a week, and then we have 2 days off.
Right.
And so you would take your 2 days off, and you'd get off work at Grand Canyon. You have to drive to Flagstaff, which is an hour and a half away, and you've got a van.
A
camper van. Okay, yeah. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So you've got a place to stay in your camper van, and there's clearly parking out in the parking lot there.
Yeah.
So then you would work a Saturday for 12 hours and back that into midnight, and then work Sunday from 12 to midnight.
Usually it was 7 to 7.
12 midnight to 12 noon.
Or 7 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Okay.
7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and there were other shifts that I worked later on. But, yes, I started off, unfortunately, at night shift, and then I went to day shift, but...
And then you would drive back to the canyon to show up for work on Monday morning.
Oh, it gets better. It gets better, yeah. But and I would only do that once or twice a month. But the other interesting thing is in 2000, when I decided to go back to school to get my PhD, my field work was on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, north rim, Yellowstone National Park, Everglades. I went to many places, but my field work where I would it was in fire ecology, and I was looking at the effects, I'm really digressing now, the effects of fire over time on the plants and animals. And so I would, do you really want, can I go into this for a second?
No, because we're going to pick that up when we get to 2000.
Okay, but the bottom line was is,
yeah.
I would go out in the evening, I'd work a shift at South Rim, I would go out in my camper van. I'd set out the traps for my mammals. I'd pick them up the next morning at 4:30, go back, shower, put in my uniform, and go back to work on South Rim. And then twice a month I would go work at Flagstaff Medical Center. So I actually did quite a bit at one time. I'm a person who has a lot of energy, and I like to describe myself as a doer, D-O-E-R.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not a rolling stone.
Nice. So, okay, so you got your RN in 1996, late 96, early 97.
97, 97.
What were your clinicals at Maricopa like?
Oh, they were just the typical things. Everybody's telling you what to do. The final exams were, a lot of us thought they were ridiculous. There was a gal who came out in tears, and the things that they emphasized, because this is not for emergency room. This is just as a registered nurse.
Okay.
So a woman went in to go take a patient history, and she didn't pull the curtain totally closed, and they flunked her.
Wow.
Because patient's privacy was of utmost, you know.
Hmm.
And I had an advantage because there was like a station where you gave injections and stuff, and I've been doing that for like 20 years as a paramedic and starting IVs. And so all of those nuts and bolts things for me were a piece of cake. But it was the things related to in-hospital care, which was my least experienced thing, that I just had to be anal about. So it wasn't that hard. I have good memory management. I'm able to remember things well.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was not that difficult, and I passed them all. And then you take something called the NCLEX, which is the NCLEX, which is the nursing exam, and you take it on a computer, and there are the way you take it is it gives you a question, you answer it, and then it gives you a harder question, in another, and then you answer it, and then it goes to another category. And if it gives you a third question and you don't answer it, then it drops down to an easier question.
Hmm.
So the computer decides if you know your stuff or if you're, like, gasping.
Hmm.
So the most you can take is 300 questions, or the least you could take is 75. If after 75 questions it's obvious you know what you're doing, the computer kicks you out and gives you your RN.
Uh-huh.
If you go to 300 questions, you may still pass. The chances are the computer's decided you need to go study some more.
Hmm. Okay.
So I got kicked out at 75.
Okay.
And I got my RN. Yeah. So I got my NCLEX, which is my ability to apply for a license then. So I applied for a license both in Arizona and California because I knew I was going to come back to California eventually someday.
That makes sense. How old were you in 1997?
Oh, well, let's see, 96 when I did it is I was 41.
So this is the concept of a mature student, I guess, an older learner. They have wonderful names for people who come back in mid-career to pick up degrees. And
after that, I got my PhD. So I just love to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's...
Even if I didn't do anything with it, I just love to learn. I took a California Naturalist class during COVID last year online. So
Nice. Did you use your RN skills at Grand Canyon? Because I seem to remember seeing you quite a bit in the clinic, in the South Rim Clinic with Dr. Wergler and Dr. Myers. And now this all makes way more sense.
for the first 5 years, 6 years I was at Grand Canyon, they were all experienced 20 years as a paramedic skill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think, well, not 20 years, but at that point, 10 years. And then when I became a flight nurse, basically flying patients from Grand Canyon to, you know, the Flagstaff Medical Center, Level 1 Trauma Center, wherever it was,
mm-hmm.
It didn't really change my skill set because they were still emergencies,
right?
Field emergencies.
Right.
But after I finished with the National Park Service and I was waiting for Kent to finish with the National Park Service, I did take a job part-time as a clinic nurse at the clinic.
Okay.
When Tom Myers was there.
Mm-hmm.
So, which was okay, but it was boring to me.
Yeah, I bet.
unless I brought something. But it was nursing, but not my joy of nursing. I thrive on bring it on kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Challenge me. I could do this. I mean, because as a flight nurse, as a paramedic, as an ER nurse, I mean, we're all trained to run codes all by ourselves. If the doctor's not there, that doesn't matter. We'll start the IV. As a paramedic, I can intubate patients. Nurses cannot intubate patients. So I was able to bring double skill sets.
Great. Yeah. That's really, I mean, again, I just think about an asset, what an asset you were, and still are, of course, you know, to the Park Service, to Grand Canyon at the time. It's just amazing, amazing skill sets there. Very neat. What else do you recall about this time? We're in the 1995 to 2000 time period.
This is also the time I started something called Resource Management and the Protection Ranger. And one of the things that came up, and it was driven by finances of all things, is this is right when all of the talk about stovepiping that we talked about before, about protection rangers are really police officers, and they didn't want to give park rangers any kind of enhanced pay because all they were police officers. But if you were a resource manager, that's a different set of skills. And right there, what the fight was on, because those on South Rim who wanted to be 100% law enforcement and didn't want to do EMS, SAR, fire, or anything else of that ilk, didn't want to do that. And there was actually talk of bringing Capitol Police officers to the Grand Canyon to be the police force, and then the rangers would do everything but law enforcement. And so at that time, they didn't want the park rangers that were there didn't want that to happen because they wanted to be the police officers too. But they also wanted to have recognition as pay, and already having a master's degree in biology and having experience in resource management, I decided that I was going to educate my colleagues so that they could, that so that we could justify that we are resource managers, which is supposed to be our number one job, is not protecting the people, but protecting the resource. So I started a hand type thing and later a computer type thing that I named RNPR, Resource Management and the Protection Ranger. And every issue would talk about environment and ecotone and animal, how the elk were introduced, what about the condors. I would talk about the bighorn sheep. I would talk about the ringtail cats. I would talk about the pinyon juniper forest. I'd talk about ponderosa pine. I would talk about and educate my colleagues, on what Grand Canyon was all about. I remember being on horse patrol and riding up to the El Tovar with a person who had been there many years before me. I don't want to embarrass the person by saying this. And the person came up and said, "Why is it called El Tovar?" And he immediately said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, it was named for Simon de Tovar, who was with the conquistadores, and he came to the South Rim, and da-da-da-da." And the guy just, that my colleague just looked at me and went, "Whoa." You know, because it was important to me to know about my national park.
Yeah, the history, so, the history of what's in a name.
Natural
yeah.
History and all that kind of stuff.
Was this once a quarter or once a month? How often did you put those out?
Once a month.
Wow.
I believe. And so I put it out for many years. I think I have 36 or 37 issues, something like that, front and back. But one of the things I used to do is to show what it was, is I always had a column on a law, like what is the Lacey Act? And the Lacey Act is possession of migratory animal parts is illegal. And, you know, and that's a federal law. And I would put it down what it was in the Code of Federal Regulations, what it encompassed, and how we enforce it and here at Grand Canyon. Hmm. So, for instance, you stop a car and they have raven feathers, like a lot of people do, on their dashboard. That's illegal because they're migratory birds.
Right.
And then I might talk about, you know, another act, you know, or I might talk about another law in the superintendent's compendium. But every issue, I would talk about something in law enforcement that applied to the resources. I'd talk about poaching. I would talk about the illegal placement of salt licks and all that kind of stuff. So it was really important. So, and, of course, I learned by doing it myself.
I bet.
And I made sure all of my colleagues had it, that administrative had it, and I gave it to the judge magistrate, who at that time was Judge Verkamp. What's his first name, Tom?
Steve.
Steve Verkamp, that's right.
What do you remember Verkamp about him?
Oh, Steve Verkamp. Well, let me get back. But
okay, we'll go back to him.
No, we can do that. But I just want to say the Verkamp family was historically present in the Grand Canyon, and they had a store there. And yeah, remind me to come back to the store and the attic, because that is a very important story.
Okay.
If you write that down, Verkamp's.
Done. Verkamp's store attic. No, I got it. That's good.
Yeah.
So
in the Hopi House. So
Let's back up a minute. Because you mentioned stovepiping and you mentioned resource management and protection rangers. And when I think of resource management, I think of the science center and its air quality, its exotic species, its plants, it's fire,
and I would address
caves.
Topics every issue. Yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, when I think of protection ranger, I don't think of resource management.
Right. And that's, if you look at our job description, that's number one.
Is resource management.
Resource management.
Well, I think of resource protection. I mean, unimpaired,
Nope. We are managers.
Okay.
We are managers. That's our number one job, is to protect the resource from people. And secondarily, it's to protect the people from the resource and then the people from the people. I mean, it's just,
right.
It's the park was their first kind of an attitude. And
but
it's been who's, anyway.
It just seems like so many Well, help me out here, because I would assume that some, to be clear, protective rangers may just look at people on people, and would
that's,
sort of.
That's why we had the issues we had.
Okay.
People on South Rim and other places of the park did not want to be resource managers. They did not want to be on search and rescue. They didn't even want to be EMTs. They just wanted to be police officers. And
well,
that's where we
can
had
I,
a big problem.
Can I play the devil's advocate here a little bit, or at least
sure.
try? As a physical therapist, I know nothing about this. But I would think, okay, as a protective ranger, I wear a weapon. I'm trained at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy. I know how to take down the bad guys. I know traffic violations. I know the law and the letter of the law. And then you want to add on top of that, I need to know about the resource, about how the resource works. That's a whole nother level of complexity.
It is. So here you are in the National Park Service.
Right.
In the National Park Service, you might have 10 of the over 400 park areas where the people calls are like a city. We're talking about Yellowstone, Yosemite, Gateway, Grand Canyon, Golden Gate, Lake Mead, and on like that. I could go on a list like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Tuzigoot, if you go to Death Valley, if you go to Everglades, if you go to Roosevelt, if you go to Badlands, the number of police type calls that you have might be one or two a week,
okay,
or a month. So your primary job at these places is a resource manager. The number what we used to keep in the back of our vehicles at Death Valley were rakes, because people would drive off road and we would never catch them, and we'd go out and we'd rake the wheel marks, so it would encourage other people to do that. We would manage the resource.
Right. Okay.
You know, at Devil's Tower, we close the tower to hiking at certain parts of the year so they don't mess with peregrine falcons up there.
Mm-hmm.
The same at Morro Rock at Sequoia National Park. But because every now and then you're going to get a Danny Ray horning, or you're going to get a drunk driver, you're going to get something, you have to have that skill set. In the parks that have not one or two a month, but one or two an hour, it seems,
right,
at Grand Canyon or one of the others, that's when you have more skills amongst the rangers. So, for instance, at Death Valley National Monument, now Death Valley National Park, we were concurrent jurisdictions. We did law enforcement in the Death Valley, but Inyo County Sheriff's Department also did, they shared it with us concurrent.
Yes.
Private lands like Furnace Creek Ranch,
okay,
we had no say. We couldn't do anything there. That was private land, and the sheriff had to do it. We had a memorandum of understanding that we would go in and assist them.
Okay.
But we couldn't do anything else. So places that don't have a lot of protection needs either have proprietary jurisdictions, where they can only write a parking ticket, they don't do any investigations, don't do any arrests, or they have concurrent jurisdiction, or if you're at a place like Grand Canyon or Sequoia or Kings Canyon, some of the others, you may have exclusive, where now you have rangers who not only have to do write the tickets, do the investigation, make the vehicle stops, arrest the people, make their case in court, and take them to jail. So within the National Park Service, you've got quite a few places which are little cities. And that's why the talk went to stovepiping in places like this, why the talk went to having investigative officers at these places, why Grand Canyon ultimately ended up with court officers so that I didn't have to go like I did in Death Valley and be the presenting court officer in a DUI case.
Okay.
And then we have a traveling U.S. judge magistrate that showed up, I don't remember schedule, once or twice a week or something. And then you have people so busy that now the resource is left in the dust.
And then there's a fire, or then there's a some sort of emergency call out.
Right.
So now these duties, these list of duties are really starting to get overwhelming.
Which is why there was talk of having police officers coming in and being the police, have private ambulance companies coming in and being the paramedics.
Okay.
And having, quote, park rangers just be search and rescue and Andy Taylor's kind of things.
Uh-huh.
And nobody wanted to do that split up. I didn't want to do that split up. I wanted the variety. I could do the variety. There's some people who didn't want to do the resources stuff. So it was contentious. And I don't know what the answer was other than eventually we would go, we did bring an ambulance company in at the end of my career, and they staged in Tucson, and they would often come in and take the patients to the hospital rather than us do it. They often responded to calls. And a lot of this started during Danny Ray Horney, when we brought in the FBI to help with the investigation, when we had over 500 people, law enforcement in there. Plus, you had ambulance companies from Phoenix coming up and taking the calls because everybody was busy trying to capture this murder kidnapper.
Hmm. Okay.
So that was the idea that you could bring in outsiders. But the majority of national park areas, there's just not enough calls. So you want the ranger to be able to break the tracks and to collar the animals, to give the evening programs,
mm-hmm.
places where this happens,
yeah.
To do all that stuff. In fact, that's what the California State Parks still do, is their rangers give the programs.
Nice.
As well as the
uh-huh.
interpreters. But it not in places like Pismo Beach, where they're too busy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Okay.
And I stopped with the National Park Service in 2003, so I can't speak of what happened in the last 18 years.
Right, but we'll at least get to 2003. So yeah, maybe this is a good time to put a comma here in this oral history.
And I would love to tell you about Steve Verkamp.
Right, I've got him down on my list of things to talk about next time.
Right.
Okay, well, with that, this will conclude part 10 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Melody Meekum. Today is Wednesday, April 21, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom.